It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, and you're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Congress is ultimately responsible for deciding on tax policy, but voters want to know where presidential candidates stand. We compare their positions. First, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is getting a lot of attention for comments made to journalists yesterday about who might get the GOP nomination in a contested convention.
If someone can get to 1237 before the convention, it'll obviously have to be an existing candidate. If they don't, that's ultimately up to the delegates. There's no criteria one way or the other. It could be one of the three. It could be somebody who ran before. It could be somebody who hasn't ever run for president before. And the beauty is that the people get to decide that, not the party leaders.
Joining us now is Jesse Opoyan, who covers state government and politics for the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So, Jesse, you've written about Governor Walker's statements, and we just heard a clip of that. What prompted him to comment now about the nominee in a potentially contested convention?
Well, he was asked. I was there yesterday, and I asked, but, the question's kind of been out there for a few weeks now, or months even, as it seems increasingly likely that Donald Trump is the most likely nominee, but still there's a possibility that he may not end up with that majority that's needed to earn the nomination automatically. So then the question arises, well, who's it going to be? And there's certainly been some speculation about some Wisconsin figures, so it seemed like a good question for the governor while the candidates are crisscrossing the state over these next couple of weeks getting ready for the April 5th primary.
Well, and as you said, he was asked, but I'm guessing he also probably had opportunities to say basically the same thing at earlier points. Do you think it is because the Wisconsin primary is coming up that he decided this was a good time to kind of throw those ideas out there?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. I mean, he's being very careful and deliberate with what he says and won't say about who he would support or who he thinks it may be. He's not outright necessarily criticizing Donald Trump, but making it pretty clear that that's not someone that he would support. He's holding off on making an endorsement for another few days, but doesn't want to wait till too late either. He wants to make sure he hits the exact right moment to have the most possible impact. So he's definitely considering very carefully when he can say these things and what exactly he should be saying.
So in those comments that he made that we just heard, he said it could be one of the three that are still running. It could be someone who was running before but is no longer in the race. It could be someone who hasn't run. Now, some of the national press have been saying that mention of people who were running but aren't at this point could be a hint that maybe he would be the nominee. Do you think that was part of the subtext there?
It certainly could have been. I didn't get a chance to push him and ask if that's what he was thinking, but that's obviously been some of the speculation. There's also been a little bit of talk of sort of the three R's is how it's being put. You know, there's Marco Rubio, who just dropped out, who certainly had a lot of support here in Wisconsin. There's former nominee Mitt Romney, and there's the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. So there's some other options there, too, including at least one other who did already run this time around.
So in your article, Jesse, you remind readers that when Governor Walker was leaving the presidential race, he called several times for the remaining Republican candidates to clear the field for a positive alternative to Donald Trump. So could he actually be in a pretty good position as being seen as a strong conservative option who hasn't played into the very public Trump bashing by other party members?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he said that early on, and no one really paid attention for a little while. I think the next person to drop out was Bobby Jindal. And then, sure enough, as we keep getting closer and closer to the convention, candidates are saying, all right, you know, we've got to coalesce around someone who's not Trump. And we are seeing people like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio not only dropping out, but throwing their support to someone like Ted Cruz, who months ago you probably couldn't envision, but it's happening now. And, yeah, I think there's got to be credit or acknowledgement made of the fact that this was something Governor Walker was talking about months ago.
Well, and the other side of that is that Governor Walker withdrew from the race a lot earlier than a lot of people expected. And it's also been said that because he left the field so early, he was not around long enough to be the object of a lot of criticism from Donald Trump. Might that also help him in consideration?
Definitely. You know, and that's not to say that Donald Trump didn't have things to say about Scott Walker. He certainly knocked him for things that he viewed as going poorly in Wisconsin, you know, poor job performance, this or that. He said things about Scott Walker, but it never got personal. It never got all that nasty, and he didn't focus on him too terribly much. So, you know, you compare that to what we have going on with Ted Cruz right now, or, you know, a few weeks ago, Marco Rubio and little Marco and you know, going after him for being sweaty. I mean, Scott Walker never had to deal with that from Donald Trump.
We're talking with Jessi Apoyan. She covers state government and politics for the Capital Times. Now, John Kasich is another governor like Scott Walker with similar claims, who is still in the race, still on the ballot. Would you expect him and his campaign to maybe push back on the idea that they have to go outside of the current ballot to find a potential nominee?
Yeah, you know, he's been pretty clear that he's not considering dropping out or holding back at all as we go forward leading up to April 5th. It seems like sort of the conventional opinion of his campaign at this point among a lot of Republicans in Wisconsin is they like his campaign. They like what he's doing. They like his record, and it is similar in many ways to that of Scott Walker, so that makes sense, but they don't see him as being a viable alternative to Donald Trump at this point. They don't necessarily see him as being a viable alternative to Hillary Clinton. But yeah, the Kasich campaign is, they had a town hall this week. They've got three scheduled next week. They've got a couple other events coming up, so they're definitely focusing on Wisconsin.
Some leading Republicans over the past few weeks are still expressing hope of Speaker Paul Ryan emerging as the nominee at a contested convention. What kind of odds would you give that for happening?
Oh, man. I, much like Governor Scott Walker, am reluctant to try to predict much in this election because everyone's predictions have been wrong. I know I said months ago that we wouldn't still be talking about Donald Trump, you know, 3-6 months from now at that point, and here we are. So I don't know if I'd put a number on it, but I will say this. You know, he said he didn't want to be Speaker of the House. He said he didn't want to do that. He says he doesn't want to be president. We'll see.
And so we will watch Speaker Ryan as this goes on. He also gave a speech this week on the state of American politics that was not only a more civil response to the Trump movement, but what could be interpreted as going out and trying to sound very presidential and really emphasizing those leadership skills. Do you think that was Ryan's intention, or is he just trying to kind of position himself as a powerful speaker?
You know, I think that at the very least his intention was to criticize Donald Trump without calling him out by name. So much of his presence as Speaker of the House has been presidential in many ways. He gives a lot of speeches. He talks a lot about the party and the country and the state of just where we are right now. He's got a strong social media presence. He's got a strong press presence. He's got what would seem like a campaign operation, but maybe that's just his approach to being Speaker. It's something I guess we'll find out over the next couple months.
You mentioned Mitt Romney earlier as one of the possibilities that could come out of a brokered convention. Is that something that you think the Republican base would be excited about, or are they seeing it as, you know, we have to find the lesser of two or more evils?
I think there's a little bit of both there. I've definitely talked to some Republicans who are longing for the days of Mitt Romney, whether that's the state of the race right now or they are genuinely excited about him possibly coming back as a candidate. There is absolutely a presence within the party that's saying it would be nice to have him back in front of the field.
So just as we wrap up, Jessi, so the Republican Party leadership is trying to throw everything they can in the way of Donald Trump to deny him the nomination. Donald Trump is saying if he gets the delegates and doesn't get the nomination, there might be riots. Regardless of what happens in Cleveland at the Republican convention, is there any way that the party can emerge intact?
Man, that's a loaded question. Yes, I mean, of course. This is shaking the party up quite a bit. This is giving them a little bit of a gut check. It's making them stop and say, all right, what do we really stand for? What do we want to be known for? And if Donald Trump's not the nominee, then they get to sort of walk away from it and be okay. But if he is, then they have to maybe take a different direction. Maybe we see some sort of third party, something going on. But they do have a chance to decide at this point. You know, what does the Republican Party really want to be?
Well, Jessi, we'll certainly keep in touch with you as the campaign continues.
Okay, we'll be looking forward to it.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
That was Jessie Apoyan, who covers state government and politics for the Capital Times. She was talking with us about Governor Walker's comments that the GOP nominee could be someone who's not currently in the race. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll talk with an Irish chef who will serve up some Easter cooking ideas with an Irish twist, and we'll get her recipe for Irish breakfast tortilla. First, tax policies and the impact of policies and laws on taxpayers is a prominent part of presidential campaigns. But it can be hard to separate truth from campaign PR. With the Wisconsin presidential primary coming up on Tuesday, April 5th, we thought it was a good time to try and get a handle on the specifics of the tax plans of the candidates who are still running. Joining us now is Beth Logan. She's the owner of Kozlog Tax Advisors and is the author of The Voter's Guide to Tax Policy 2016. Beth, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what I think is a really important point. Who actually makes tax policy?
It actually comes from Congress, which pretty much means that their aides write it. The ideas can come from anywhere. If you've ever seeing the way Washington works, sometimes even constituents make comments that lead to things that we've had banking laws changed because an aide complained. So the ideas can come from all sorts of places, but then the congressmen write it and it goes through the legislative process, and the president's real only role is to veto it or sign it.
So that really kind of begs the question, why do presidential candidates talk so much about tax policy?
Well, I think there's two reasons. And the first one is there's an expectation that the president's going to have thoughts on all the different issues. And we're hoping that he or she can effectively communicate them, and then we can respond to those policies based, you know, to see are they going to encourage Congress to do things or are they going to veto a certain policy. So there is some place for the president in it. I think the other thing is tax has become a very hot topic. So the Tea Party calls themselves taxed enough already. And so people want to hear these things, even if it leads nowhere. They want their candidate to be on their side of tax policy.
So when we first scheduled this interview, Beth, there were a lot more candidates that were still in the running. The field has narrowed quite a bit since then. So let's focus in on those that are still in the running. First of all, how did you compile this information?
Well, I started by going through what they had written on their websites. Then I went and dug a little deeper into other sources that I could find, but I was trying to use as close to first-person sources. And then I actually went into New Hampshire, and I tried to find and ask questions of all the candidates. I also contacted all of the campaign offices, and sadly only one responded, and that was Lindsey Graham's team.
We'll be framing a lot of this in terms of the impact on middle-class families. Who falls into the category of middle class?
Well, the average household income is around $50,000 or $55,000 right now. So middle class is usually thought to be somewhere between maybe $35,000 and $100,000. Some people will push middle class up to more like $150,000 or $170,000. The number is just the countrywide average.
So let's start talking about tax policy on the Republican side. You say that Donald Trump removes exemptions for dependents, so taxpayers with families wouldn't have any more deductions than those who do not have minor children or other types of dependents. That seems like a huge change.
It is a large change. There's actually a couple other candidates who had proposed this, and part of this goal is to, quote-unquote, simplify, but what they don't understand in simplifying is that you are having a big impact on certain groups. The irony of Trump's is it's pretty much the exact opposite of where Rubio was going, which is the more children you have, the more deductions you should have. So it's interesting to see that within the Republican Party there is such diversity. He is setting the standard deduction higher, so it's close to having 2.1 children, but he's lowering the tax bracket. So his tax bracket, which I'm assuming would be 39.6%, which is the highest, although he hasn't released his tax return, would actually be lowered to 25%. And in the process, the others would be lowered as well. So he is likely to bring in less money, and actually the Wall Street Journal put out an article thinking that it's going to be significantly less.
You just mentioned tax brackets, and John Kasich wants to reduce the number of tax brackets and also cap the tax bracket, I understand, at the tax rate of 28%. What would that do to the amount of tax revenue that's available?
It would be pretty much the same thing as Donald Trump, because they'd be bringing in less taxes. And he also, Kasich also wants to lower the capital gains tax to only a maximum of 15%. And right now, the only people who pay 20% are those people who are in the highest tax bracket. So they have to be earning something like over $400,000, kind of depends on whether you're single, married, filing jointly, that. But only people making over $400,000 pay 20% in capital gains. And so he's really lowering it for the wealthy. And you could argue that that's not going to make a significant impact because there aren't that many wealthy, but that's who it's really benefiting.
We're talking with Beth Logan. She's the owner of Kozlug Tax Advisors, as well as an enrolled agent. She's a nationally published tax author and wrote The Voter's Guide to Tax Policy 2016. Now, currently, Social Security contributions are made by both the employee and the employer, but Ted Cruz would change that. What's his proposal?
What he's looking at is telling businesses that the only thing they can deduct is cost of goods sold and capital expenses. Today, a business takes their income and they deduct pretty much all of their expenses, which includes wages and rent and utilities and other expenses like that. So by leaving the wages in and not making them deductible, he's taxing the wages at the full amount that he's taxing the income, and that would be 16%. So instead of a business paying 7.65% of FICA and then the employee paying 7.65, he's having the business pay an entire 16%. So that's a little bit more. But my concern with this is people might think, ooh, great, I don't have to pay my 7.65% FICA. But if I'm an employer and I have employees that are currently paying it, now all of a sudden I'm paying the 16%. I'm going to cut their wages to balance out, so I'm not sure it's going to benefit people.
Let's turn to the Democrats now. You quote Hillary Clinton as saying, if your family makes less than $250,000 a year, your taxes won't go up. From what you've seen of her policies, does that ring true?
Yes, that rings true. All of the policies she's released are for higher income, except for one. She does want to change the capital gains. During the George W. Bush administration, they made the capital gains a lower tax rate on long-term capital gains than short-term capital gains or regular wages. She would actually change that long-term from 1 year to 6 years and step it up. So instead of it being capped at 20%, it would each year would be different caps up until you get to 20%. So it would go from 39.6% to 20% over a six-year time instead of over 1 year. And that could have a very minimal impact on lower-income people, but usually people who have a decent amount of capital gains investments have a higher income anyway.
So you've been talking about capital gains, and Bernie Sanders also wants to tax capital gains at the same rate as income, however. What does that mean exactly, and how big a change is that?
Well, that brings us back to where we were in the Bill Clinton administration, because that's how it had been back then. And for most people, their capital gains, for most middle-class people, they have somewhere between zero and, a couple thousand dollars. You might have some people who have received, like employee stock purchase or restricted stock options, who are only making maybe $150,000 a year, who have capital gains, but they're usually not a lot. And this would just raise that to match their wages, what I'm seeing is that the Republicans pretty consistently want to eliminate the estate tax. And so if they maintain control of the House and the Senate, they may push for that. And that would actually be detrimental to the middle class because the estate tax has something called a stepped-up basis, which means you inherit the assets at the value on the day of death. If you remove the estate tax, you then remove this stepped-up basis, and the children are inheriting the house at the value that the parents paid, which could be, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 even. And then they'd have to pay the gains, the same capital gains tax we were talking about, on that profit when they sell the house. So that's one that concerns me because there are so many Republicans that are for it, and I'm not sure there's a thorough understanding of the tax that is going to be added to middle-class families after the death of a family member.
Well, Beth Logan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Beth Logan is the owner of Kozlug Tax Advisors and is the author of The Voter's Guide to Tax Policy 2016. Coming up next on Food Friday, we'll talk with an Irish chef and TV personality who will offer up some tasty Irish cuisine to serve for Easter. And we'll invite you to join in. Does your family have an Easter tradition or favorite dish? We'd love to hear about it. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. It's time for Food Friday, and with Easter coming up this weekend, we thought that it would be a good time to think about some culinary ways to celebrate. And we'd like to hear from you. If you celebrate Easter, what are some of your favorite dishes that you look forward to? Do you have a favorite meal to make for friends and family? And if so, what is it? And why do you love it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And you probably noticed that Irish music, and that's because we're joined now by chef and TV food personality Clodagh McKenna. Her latest book is called Clodagh's Irish Kitchen, and she's here to tell us about Irish cuisine and to offer up some culinary ideas to help us celebrate Easter. Clodagh, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, happy Easter.
Happy almost Easter to you. And your new book, as we said, is Clodagh's Irish Kitchen. It's full of modern takes on traditional Irish cooking. And so, first of all, let's talk about that traditional cooking. What are some of those traditional Irish dishes?
Well, I wanted to... I mean, I love Ireland and I love Irish cooking, and I really wanted to kind of look back at older traditional dishes like, you know, soda bread or like, you know, bacon and cabbage, or, you know, even, you know, different porter cakes, and see how I could put, you know, my fresh twist on it or my clean, you know, kind of make it more contemporary and make it the flavor more modern. I guess like with my soda bread, I do really lovely white soda breads now with chorizo in them. Like with my, and then the bacon and cabbage, I do a gorgeous bacon and cabbage soup. I do a Kilcannon soup. There's a Guinness cake. Yeah, there's lots of delicious recipes in there.
And so when you're talking about putting modern spins on more traditional dishes, whether it's in Irish cooking or in other cuisines, what do you think it is that kind of brings those old tried and true dishes up until the present day?
Well, for me, I grew up with them. So that means that like those recipes have a soft spot in me, you know, like they... Mm-hmm. When I cook them, I feel really good. It feels very good for my soul when I cook, you know, Irish traditional dishes because I'm Irish. And I wanted to kind of make people feel that way too. You know, I mean, there's so many people who have Irish heritage and that, you know, would have visited Ireland or, you know, have a relative that might have been from Ireland or something. And it's, I think cooking Irish food is just a wonderful way to really connect with your culture, you know, and keeping those Irish traditional dishes because they are really good, hearty dishes. I mean, we do soul food really, really well in Ireland. But I guess my recipes are just a little bit lighter. So, you know, I don't like eating heavy food, but I do love comfort food as well. so that my book is a bit of a mix of comfort food, but also quite light dishes as well.
I think it's interesting because pretty much any cuisine, when you look back at recipes and how things were prepared decades ago, people were doing a lot more manual labor, and life was not quite as easy as a mouse click away to do almost everything. And so lightening them up is also kind of a response to how we live now.
Well, yes, exactly. And we also crave, you know, different types of flavors. Like I did my, or I've got this really lovely recipe for ice cream, and I do it with soda bread. It's a soda bread ice cream with Baileys. And basically, you don't need an ice cream maker to make it. You just pop it straight into the freezer. And you make up, you know, your custard base, you know, with the milk and the eggs and the sugar. So super simple. And then with the soda bread, I crumble all the soda bread with brown sugar I sprinkled on top into the oven until I like little crispy nuggets. I fold that through the custard mix I've made, some Baileys in there, into the freezer. I take it out every hour or so, stir it around, and hey-ho, you've got the most fantastic ice cream. I made it on the Rachel Ray Show, this program that I do quite a lot. And she said it was one of the best ice creams she'd ever had.
It sounds delicious.
It really is. So good.
So often when we talk about the cuisine of a particular country or maybe a particular region, when we kind of boil down what we're talking about, there are a few flavors or ingredients, maybe spices or seasonings that really evoke that particular cuisine. Are there some of those really Irish flavors that when you taste it, you automatically think Ireland?
Yeah, for me there are. There's, you know, like smoked salmon, I think, for me, potato, definitely leeks and cabbage and all those root vegetables, and then soda bread. I mean, soda bread for me is quintessential Ireland for me, and lamb, I love lamb. What else? Black pudding, bacon chops, yeah, they're kind of cheese as well, all different, like, lovely, fresh kind of goat cheeses and, yeah, those things. I like cooking with stout as well. Like, I like putting a bit of stout in my cooking. I also like drinking stout, like my Guinness. But I like cooking with stout as well, and that taste would definitely be Irish for me. Like, I love cooking my beef stew. I have a gorgeous recipe on my website for a beef stew with Guinness.
Mm.
And I put mushrooms and shallots in it, and I cook it for about 2 or 3 hours, slow cooking. It's not, you know, not my time. I just let it simmer away in the oven in a very low heat. And I love cooking with stout with that because it adds a lovely kind of caramel flavor to it. It really enriches the stew.
So Ireland is surrounded by ocean, and you mentioned smoked salmon. But other than that, is fish a large part of Irish cuisine?
It is. I mean. I grew up in a home where fish was a big part of our cooking and our family because my grandpa was a fisherman and so was my uncle. And everybody in Ireland is related somehow to a fisherman. And definitely, I think we went through a phase, or Ireland went through a phase, where we didn't appreciate so much the fish that we have. And I think that's changing now, definitely, over the past 10 years. People have definitely turned towards the sea and, you know, are learning to cook better with fish. I mean, our prawns, the Dublin Bay prawns, are fantastic. I cooked them the other day in just a tiny bit of gin, just a splash of gin, because it's so good with it. You don't have to put in gin. Tomatoes, chili, and then just put it all through tagliatelle, and it was absolutely gorgeous.
Mm.
Tonight, because it's Good Friday here, and all my family, I don't know if you can hear them in the background, our house is packed because all my family are here and we're all cooking fish.
Oh.
So my sister actually got beautiful fresh fish in Kerry that was caught today, and we've got plates, so we're just going to, you know, because it was caught today, we're just going to lightly flour it. And then fry it off in beautiful salted Irish butter, and then maybe a little bit of herb on top, and we'll be having that with my mom's creamy mashed potato and some vegetables, and then we're having a big apple crumble afterwards.
Well, we do have Kenneth in Janesville on the line, so let's go to the phones. Hi, Kenneth.
I was wondering if you knew, is soda bread a comfort food?
Well, I mean, I think of it as being a comfort food. Just because it's something that I grew up with. And when I bake my soda bread, which I do about twice a week at home. It's my, you know, it's my staple bread at home. It's a very comforting feeling. Does that answer the question?
Oh, we can only get it around St. Patrick's Day, and, you know, the day after St. Patrick's, it's gone.
Oh, you should make it, Kenneth. Is this Kenneth on the phone, did
yes.
you say? Hi, Kenneth.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
And,
you should make it. It's so easy to make it.
Yeah, it's not very complicated, is it, Clodagh?
No, Kenneth, all you need is plain flour, wholemeal flour, and then you mix them together, and then you just need to get bicarbonate of soda or baking soda, which you can get in all the stores in the States, and then you just add in buttermilk, mix it around, and literally pat it down, and it goes in. You can, if you want to see me making it, I did make it on the Rachel Ray Show, so you could go onto her website. Or if you just want the recipe, you can go onto my website, clodaghmckenna.com, and the recipe is up in my recipe page, and you can just, you know, write it down. But it's so easy. I hope you make it, Kenna, because it's one of the easiest breads to make.
Well, I'm actually tempted to make it because it reminded me of how good it is, Clodagh. And so clodaghmckenna.com, it's CLODAGHMCKENNA, correct?
That's it.
All right. Well, we are talking with Irish chef Clodagh McKenna about how to celebrate Easter with modern takes on traditional Irish food. When we come back in just a bit, we are going to get her recipe for Irish breakfast tortilla. And we'd like to hear from you. Does your family have special Easter traditions that you look forward to? Are they linked to your ethnic heritage? Maybe this conversation has you interested in Irish cooking. Clodagh is happy to offer advice and inspiration for a great Irish-themed meal. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're talking with Chef Clodagh McKenna. Her latest book is called Clodagh's Irish Kitchen, and it offers up a modern take on traditional Irish cuisine. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite dishes to serve up around Easter? Do you have Easter food traditions that come from your family's ethnic heritage? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, Clodagh, we've been talking around Easter, but we haven't actually gotten into it. And as you said, you have a house full of people getting ready. So let's say we're hosting some friends or family for an Easter feast. What are some Irish dishes that you think would appeal to a broad number of people?
Well, do you make hot cross buns? You do, don't you, in America?
We do, yes. Well, I should say, being Americans, most of us buy hot cross buns instead of making them. I personally have a fear of yeast that I'm trying to get over. But yes, we do have them here.
Well, I think to start off with, I mean, usually for Easter Sunday now, we'll be doing a nice soup to begin with. So because it's this time of year, I'm going to do a pea and smoked bacon soup, which is that gorgeous, vibrant green and, you know, it's so spring-like. And that's just a base of onion and potato, equal quantities, a little bit of garlic. You know, your stock in there, and then get some peas. Frozen peas are absolutely perfect to use in this because frozen peas are the best kind of frozen vegetable you can get.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, blitz it straight away with some fresh nutmeg is brilliant in there. It's a nice little tip. And some cream, and then crisp up some smoked bacon, and then crumble it on top before you're serving it. For main course, we always, and it's a massive tradition in Ireland, we always have roast lamb at Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, at Easter time. I mean, every table in Ireland will have roast lamb. And so I'll be studding my roast lamb with garlic and rosemary. And then I'll be serving them then with my kind of roasty potatoes, which I do with sea salt and rosemary.
Yeah.
So I'll steam off the potatoes, peel them, steam them off, and then put the frying pan over my hob, and then put a little bit of butter and oil in there and sea salt and rosemary, and then just keep tossing the potatoes in them so they get lovely and kind of golden on the outside and get the rosemary and sea salt on them. And I was actually, you know, while the news was going on, I was just discussing dessert with my mom, funny enough, because she came in and she brought my book in. And she was looking at dessert. It was so funny. And we said, she's standing in front of me. we said, I was thinking, oh, we'll make the bread and butter pudding. And then my mom was saying, oh, no, we have to do something light, like we were talking about earlier.
Oh, right.
Because we always do a big light pudding after lamb, don't we, Mom? So, so we're going to do a big meringue, pavlova. So, you know, nice one that's kind of crisp on the outside but soft on the inside, and then lovely whipped cream, and then rhubarb, because rhubarb is in season at the moment. So we'll roast up some rhubarb with a little bit of ginger, and then usually when I roast up the rhubarb with a bit of ginger, I strain off the juice and make a little, you know, make a little sugar syrup.
Mm-hmm.
And then keep that nice and thick. So just before, when people are having their pavlova with whipped cream and rhubarb, the syrup is there just to pour over. Yeah, yum.
We're all drooling here at the thought of it.
I am starving.
I want to go back to the lamb. So do you do a leg of lamb for Easter? I mean, it's a big piece of meat, but assuming that we're going to have lots of people over, that might be a great occasion to do it.
Oh, yeah, full leg of lamb. I mean, it's tradition in our house, and my mom has made it a tradition in our house for years. We always have. And my mother's here chatting in front of me, making sure I tell you the right thing.
Well, tell her we appreciate
it's
her support.
Mountain lamb, she's saying.
Oh,
that's
all right.
What we have in our house. And it's beautiful. And it, exactly. And it's the herbs that grow on the mountains that make the Kerry lamb taste so good. Oh. And she's completely right. It's wild there, and the pastures are beautiful. We're really lucky. Yeah, we're really lucky. We get it from a local butcher. I think it's good to support your butchers, mm-hmm, if you can. And that's how we have it. And it's great because then the days afterwards, it's so lovely to have that roast lamb cold with, mm-hmm, on soda bread.
Oh, you really are making us hungry. Well, let's talk about a recipe that we're featuring from your new book, Clodagh's Irish Kitchen. We have this up on the Central Time Facebook page. It's the Irish Breakfast Tortilla. And so tortilla, often here in the U.S., when we think of tortilla, we think of what you wrap around a burrito, more the Mexican kind of just a flour tortilla. But this is like a Spanish tortilla with the eggs and the potatoes.
Yeah, this is a Spanish tortilla. It's like a baked egg. It turns out like looking like a cake. That's, mm-hmm, what I can describe it as, like a visual description of it. It's so easy to make. When you have a lot of people around for breakfast, I think anything more than, you know, two or three, this is a brilliant recipe because you whisk up all your eggs and then you get, you know, your skillet pan or your frying pan. It needs to be kind of a deepish, so, you know, about like 3 inches deep. And then you've got your potatoes. So you peel your potatoes and then chop them up into small little pieces. And you've got your sausages, smoked bacon, cherry tomatoes. And then what you do is you add your, you put your onions in first and you get your potatoes in there. And you cook the onions in the potatoes and a little bit of oil in your skillet pan, you know, for about 10 minutes. And then you add in, you whisk up your eggs then, add in your eggs. And then you say, cook the bacon and the sausage separately. And then you slice them up and add them in as well. So in the mix we've got going already is the potato, the onion, the bacon, the sausage, all in this egg mixture. And then you've got your tomatoes that you're going to slice in half, cherry tomatoes, sprinkle them around on the top of it. And then you could put in a little bit of herb if you wanted to. You could put in flat leaf parsley or Italian parsley or thyme. And then that goes into the oven. And then one thing I forgot to say is at the very beginning, you grease the skillet pan properly so it doesn't stick. Pop it into the oven, and then you take it out when you're ready to serve it or when it's cooked, and then you just flip it over. So you basically put a plate on top of the pan, you turn it over, and then take the plate, the pan up, and you've got this beautiful cake, and it's a full Irish breakfast. But sliceable. So you slice it up then, and everybody has a lovely slice of it, and you can have your nice chutneys with it or your ketchup or whatever.
It also sounds like something that it would be great right out of the oven, but if it was a little, if it came more to room temperature, it sounds like it would be fine then too.
Absolutely. You could have it cold and slice it thinly and put it on a piece of bread with a little bit of aioli or mayonnaise on top.
And is, gorgeous. And is that something, it sounds like, because you'd get a little crispiness to it, is that something that a cast iron skillet would be really nice for?
Oh, perfect. Absolutely. Cast iron skillet would be, perfect for that. And it's fun. It looks lovely. I mean, I think it's lovely. I think anything that you can do in convivial, that makes the table more convivial, it makes everybody more relaxed, doesn't it? And it's easier to cook, so you're more relaxed. It'll probably taste better because you have one pan to concentrate on, mm-hmm. so you're putting all your energy into it. People feel more relaxed when they're sitting around the table because it's not so formal, and it's a little bit of fun, you know, everybody's sharing, and, you know, if there's any... you know, arguments going on in the house, it usually stops them.
Well, and I have to say, anything that has both bacon and sausage in it, I'm a fan.
Yeah, me too.
Well, Clodagh, you mentioned a convivial table, and your new book also has a section dedicated to table decorating. What kind of decorations would you maybe be having on your Easter table?
Well, I love tablescaping. It's been like a passion of mine for, I think, since I was probably about 13. I just love doing up a table. And so for Easter, I love doing an Easter sprig tree. So what you could do is you could do pussy willow branches, mm-hmm. or cherry blossom branches, which are beautiful kind of start to it. And then if you can get your hands on, I think like all the stores have them now. They're like, you know, the little eggs, but they're like paper eggs or ceramic mm-hmm. eggs or... they come in string, and you can just hang them off all the branches, which looks instantly gorgeous. The other thing I like to do is to get egg cups and fill the egg cups and fill the egg cup with, so you get an egg and you kind of cut off the top of the egg. You empty out the, so you're cutting off the top of the shell. You're emptying out the inside of the egg and you just clean it out. You pop that into the egg cup. And then fill it with flowers. And you can do a few of those around your table, which looks really, really cute as well. And I think lovely flowers. I think, you know, lovely spring flowers like daffodils. Just look gorgeous. They'll just make everything look so Eastery and spring-like, don't they?
Well, Clodagh, I wish I was coming to your Easter feast because it sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you. I hope you have a gorgeous Easter.
Thank you. Clodagh, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, pleasure.
Clodagh McKenna is a chef, TV host, and author of Clodagh's Irish Kitchen, and you can find her delicious-sounding recipe for an Irish breakfast tortilla on the Central Time Facebook page. Tonight, the Badger men's basketball team takes on Notre Dame in their fifth Sweet 16 appearance in 6 years. But while a lot of people filled out brackets for the NCAA tournament, there are other contests going on too. For example, the Williamson Street Co-op in Madison is sponsoring a local cheese challenge. Shoppers taste and vote for different Wisconsin cheeses, and at the end, the person whose bracket is closest to the winning results gets 8 pounds of the Dairy Delight. There have been some upsets already, with last year's champ, Dunbarton Blue, knocked out early by the relative newcomer, Carr Valley Cheese Wildfire Blue. The Squeaky 16 round is happening today and tomorrow. Another March bracket is the Tournament of Fictional Places, sponsored by used bookstore chain Half Price Books. It pits favorite fictional locations from books, myths, movies, music, and TV against each other. Hogwarts knocked out Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory, and Neverland sent Wonderland packing. It's sure to be tense as they go up against each other next in their bracket. Early losers were the Yellow Submarine, Hotel California, and the 100 Acre Woods. And the Cornell Lab of Ornithology does their March Migration Madness tournament this time every year, too. The contest is down to the feathered four, which are the great blue heron, cedar waxwing, belted kingfisher, and American kestrel, battling for bragging rights. So don't worry if your picks are out from the NCAA tourney. There's still hope for your favorite cheese, bird, or happy place. Stay tuned. There's news and then more Central Time here on the Ideas Network.